Professor Stein. By interviewing emeritus eminent scholars, I'm hoping to record aspects of the history of the law faculty at Cambridge that might otherwise go undocumented. Your legal career extends over 60 years to the immediate post-war era, while your memories extend to before the war. During the course of our conversations, I hope you'll be able to reminisce on some of the illustrious academics whose careers began in the pre-war years, as well as your own, and recounting your own experiences over the second half of the 20th century. If you agree, perhaps we can follow a chronological agenda and begin with your early life, which covers the period 1926 to 47.
Yeah.
You were born in Liverpool, and your father was a solicitor.
Yes. Well, he was a barrister when I was born, but he... it was in the 30s, and he didn't do very well as a barrister, so he decided in the mid-30s to switch and become a solicitor, which wasn't a very common thing in those days, because solicitors were regarded as socially inferior to barristers. But and I always remember, and it had an effect on me, that in order to be honourably disbarred from the bar, he had to pay Gray's Inn £20, which was quite a lot of money in those days, and considering that it was penury that was making him do it, I always thought that was rather mean. And that was partly why I never contemplated going to the bar myself, but became a solicitor. But
you were exposed to the law, therefore, throughout your childhood.
Well, a little bit, but I was a classicist at school, and I took the scholarship exam in Cambridge as a classicist, and when I came up as a naval cadet I think it was April 44, at the beginning of the Easter term, I had to do an academic subject as well as naval things like navigation. And so I carried on with classics then. I didn't really decide to switch from classics to law until I was away from Cambridge in the Navy, and more I thought about it, the more I thought I didn't really want to go back to classics. Forgotten a lot of Latin and Greek, and so I made up my mind then that I would switch to law and become a solicitor. And so when I came back in 47, I was away for 3 years, from 44 to 47, and in the latter part of that, the Navy enrolled me on a course to learn Japanese.
How interesting. Just coming back briefly to your school life, you were at Liverpool College in 1938.
Yes, that's
the
school.
Yes, just going back a little bit. Was there any particular reason that you went to this particular school?
Well, my father had been at it, and he was very keen that I should go to it.
And did you?
And eventually, I got a scholarship that covered all the fees.
Because I had a brief look at the website, and it's about £8,000 these days.
Oh,
so
it was
quite expensive.
45.
Did your classical background start at school?
Yes.
So you mentioned your Greek as well as your Latin. You did both of these at school.
Oh yes, of course.
And did this fire your interest in Roman history?
Well, it made it easier when I did Roman law too, because I could translate the texts without too much difficulty.
You began pre-war at the Liverpool College. Did the war affect your school life?
Well, I wasn't evacuated or anything like that. The number of boys at the school, it was purely boys. And the number of boys at the school reduced considerably during the war. A lot of people went away from Liverpool because, and the school itself was bombed. But I insisted on, I stayed. I didn't board. I stayed with my grandmother, my father's mother, who continued to live in Liverpool. And she looked after me, and I cycled to school every day. It was quite a long way. It was about 5 miles.
That's five times Grange Road.
Yes.
So we come then to the war, which you've touched upon, and may I ask, what was your role? You were in the Navy,
yes.
The Royal Navy.
Well, I started just as an ordinary sailor, but as I say, I heard about the Japanese courses, and eventually I was enrolled on one to learn Japanese in Bedford, because Bedford was near Bletchley, where the interceptions were being made.
And how did you find learning Japanese, having done Greek and Latin?
Well, it doesn't feel like learning a language. It's more like a sort of crossword puzzle. But I quite enjoyed it. It was very intensive. It lasted for 6 months. But and that was in the summer of 45 by then. And so
I'm fascinated that you learned Japanese, and did you find you put it to use during
that
time?
No, it was only to translate it. We were the lowest of the low. Interpreters spent much longer at it and were much more advanced. But I was trained just to translate intercepted radio messages. Which were put into Romaji, which is Roman letters.
Gosh.
Yeah.
It's very interesting. So, where were you posted?
For a while, I finished the course. Just about the time that the war ended, and they dropped by the dropping of the atom bombs on Hiroshima,
did you see active service?
No.
And you finished your service in 1947.
I was commissioned as a translator, but they didn't know what to do with me because the Americans had taken over all the translation. They had, after all, Americans who were of Japanese descent and who knew Japanese and were much more suited to translating than we were. But they cast around for something that we could do, and eventually decided that I should be a what they called an EVT officer, which is educational and vocational training, which largely meant handing out leaflets to sailors who were going to be demobilized as to what openings there were, you know, welding and all these various trades. And that was quite interesting, not very exciting. And I was sent to the Far East, and I was stationed in Singapore for a while, because I was education officer on the on an island off Singapore main island, which was a naval base called HMS Sultan.
So do you remember the ship that you travelled on?
It was a I can't remember the name. Oh, it was called, I think, was it called Eastern Prince, something like that. I honestly don't remember. I kept a diary then, and I could check that.
That would be interesting, perhaps next time we meet. It must have been quite exciting to have gone out.
Yes, I'd never been out of Britain before. I set off for the Far East, and we went as far as Ceylon, as it then was,
yes.
Sri Lanka now, and I reported to the sort of chief education officer in Trincomalee, and he sent me to Singapore. So eventually I arrived in Singapore. And I found that fascinating.
It must have been. Do you have any impressions that stand out? Recollections?
Not really. I did a bit of broadcasting then, because the there was a service called the British Far Eastern Broadcasting Service, and they needed readers to read these educational scripts about important figures like Delius and so on. And I did a test, and they thought my voice was quite suitable. So I used to go and broadcast occasionally for them.
Oh, lovely. And it was around about this time that you were thinking of your career.
Yes.
And you perhaps at this time applied to go to Gonville and Keys?
No, well, I'd already got an exhibition in classics there, because I took the scholarship exam at Keys before I came up as a cadet, and I'd been at Keys as a cadet. Because my father had been at Keys, in fact, and my mother was at Cambridge as well, though she never graduated because women weren't allowed to graduate in those days. Though they weren't members of the university, it was pretty shocking. And
what was her subject?
Oh, she was a modern linguist, but for French and Italian. But my father was a fanatical Kean, and I was christened in the chapel. I was born in Liverpool, but I was brought to Cambridge at a few months old in order to be christened in Keys Chapel.
That's your middle name.
Yes.
I wondered about that.
Yes.
Yes. That's interesting. And so you found yourself at Gonville and Keys from 1947 to 1950.
Yes, that's when I came out of the Navy.
Yes. So did it feel strange being back in a civilian situation?
Oh, yes, but we had to work quite hard. We had catch up, and if you were ex-service, you got all sorts of concessions, but you had to take it, you know, do everything quickly. So I did law qualifying too. That was really when I became interested in Roman law, because I had Dauba as a supervisor, and he was a very inspiring teacher.
Very interesting. I hope to come back to him when we talk about your time at Aberdeen.
Yes.
Did you find Cambridge a strange place?
No, not really, no. Well, see, I'd been a few months there 3 years before.
Any particular recollections of the college, life at college?
Well, being an exhibitioner, I lived in college. I lived in college for the whole time. I never had to have lodgings outside, which was very convenient. I made a number of friends who I still have. In fact, last Saturday I went to dinner, it was about the 60th reunion.
Oh, lovely.
Of my contemporaries. Keys.
Was there a fairly large group of you then who met last Saturday?
No, we've reduced now in numbers from death and...
Yes. Gosh. So, the staff members from that period...
But I wasn't... I didn't do law till 47.
Right.
I'd done classics when I was up before, and I switched when I came back.
And faculty members whom you would have encountered include Emeritus Professors Winfield and Guthrie.
Yes, and I never met them.
Perhaps Professors Holland?
Yes, I had lectures from Holland and Emlyn Wade.
Ah.
But I didn't do international law. You were, in those days, you chose to do international law or something else. And in law qualifying two, Roman law and international law were mutually exclusive. So you did one or the other.
So you might have had Professor Duff.
Well, yeah, I went to a few lectures, but of course I succeeded him.
Oh. Any recollections of Sir Hirsch Lauterpacht?
No.
And of the list of lecturers that we have here?
Yeah, well, yes, when I came back, the dominating figure was Hampson, really. He was regarded generally as the most sort of interesting lecturer. He did the contract lectures. I personally didn't find him quite as inspiring as a lot of other people, but I attended his course in contract.
He had a house in Cranmer Road.
Yes.
Any other recollections of people on this list? Perhaps something about David Dauba in this...
Yes, well, being at Keyes, you see, we didn't have a law fellow. Dauba was at Keyes, but he was an ex-fellow, partly, I think, for dietary reasons. He was an Orthodox Jew, and it was difficult for him to eat in college.
So,
but he supervised me, and I got to know him quite well, and it was he who sort of kept up my interest in Roman law. So when he moved to Aberdeen, he needed someone to help him, so he offered me a job.
It was in about 1953 or so that you moved up to Aberdeen, quite a bit later.
I felt I graduated in 49 as the BA, took the law tripos then, and because I could get away with 2 years solicitor's articles if I took it then at that stage. Otherwise I might have stayed a little longer in Cambridge. But I wanted to take full advantage of these concessions. So I graduated in 49, and then I discovered that you could do the LLB, as it then was, externally. So I said that I would do that, and various friends lent me their lecture notes. And so I prepared for the LLB while I was doing the first year of my articles. And I was articled to my father's firm in Southeast London. And
this would have been in about after your, well, the early 50s, perhaps?
Well, yeah, 59, I started my articles in 49. And I did 2 years articles. And I qualified in 51 as a solicitor. But in those days you had to take separate exams to become a solicitor. And
Before we move from your time at Conwell and Keyes, presumably David Dow was the most influential person.
Oh, yes.
Do you have any specific recollections of him during this time?
Well, it's difficult to separate those times when I was an undergraduate to later on.
Yes.
When I was living around the corner in Aberdeen. But I suppose it partly because I was a decent Latinist from the time that I'd been a classicist, that he took an interest in me, and I think he more or less decided that if I was willing I would be his assistant there. But just before I finished my articles in 51, I began to apply for jobs, and I applied for an assistant lectureship at Nottingham, and also for a fellowship to go to Italy to do Roman law. And I got both, fortunately.
Gosh.
But I opted to go to Italy, and but when I was away, Nottingham said, well, will you still come and be an assistant lecturer? And the salary scale then was 450 a year, and but they said, in view of my age, I was 26, they would give me 500. So I went to Nottingham for a year and agreed to stay for a year, but Aberdeen wrote in that time and said, will you come here to do Roman law? And so I said, well, I'm committed to spending a year in Nottingham. And I didn't then after that in whenever it was, in 52, I was in Italy from 51 to 52, and then I was at Nottingham from 52 to 53, and then in 53, that was the year I got married for the first time, and then I moved to Aberdeen.
Just briefly, coming before we move away from your time at Congreve and Keys, Professor Stein, do you have any memories of Professor Lipstein during that period?
No, I mean, I must have met him, but...
And Clive Parry?
No, not really.
So see, they were in a different field?
Yes.
Yes. So you were at... You actually became a solicitor in 1951, and you practiced.
No, I didn't.
You didn't?
No.
Right.
I was, having done my articles, I was qualified to practice, but I always preferred academic life.
Yeah.
And when I was in Italy, I was in a college founded by one of the few millionaire saints in the calendar. Most saints are pretty poor, but this man, some Charles Borromeo, was fabulously wealthy. And his family owned the Borromeo Islands on Lake Maggiore. And
so, in Nottingham, do you have any recollections of anybody there?
Well, I was there with my friend Thomas, J.A.C. Thomas.
I didn't realise he was from Nottingham.
Well, no, he was from here. He'd been at Trinity, and I'd known him slightly, but he was ahead of me in Cambridge. But he was very kind to me when I went to Nottingham. But he was also interested, of course, in Roman law, and... we eventually shared the course and did half each. But I also had to teach contract and conveyancing, because being a solicitor, it was assumed that I knew all about conveyancing. And so I was quite busy. I was in lodgings in Nottingham.
And you decided to go to Aberdeen.
Yeah, well, they wrote and offered me a job while I was in Nottingham, and I knew that this would mean I could go on with Roman law,
which was your main interest.
Yes.
So you became a lecturer in jurisprudence in Aberdeen.
Yes.
In 1953.
That's right.
To 56.
Yes, I am.
And then you were...
Yes, you had the two subjects were joined together, Roman law and jurisprudence. And
And you became the professor in jurisprudence in 1956.
Yes, Roger Dauber moved. He was professor of jurisprudence with responsibility both for Roman law and jurisprudence. But he He was appointed to the Regis Chair in Oxford in 55 when de Zulueta died. And I had to carry on for a while as a lecturer in charge. And then eventually they appointed me to succeed Dauber in 56. I was quite happy because my mother was a Scot.
I noticed in Who's Who that she had a Scottish surname.
Oh, yes.
Yes. So you felt at home in Aberdeen?
Reasonably, though my mother thought Aberdeen was the Arctic Circle, because she came from Edinburgh. She did occasionally come and see us.
It must have been more remote in those times, Aberdeen, than it is today.
Yes.
You know, it's had all that oil.
Yeah, that was long
boom.
Before the oil.
Yes.
And
it was just a real sort of granite,
yes,
austere city.
It was pretty austere. But I enjoyed it there. And there were plenty of grants to enable you to go away to libraries if you needed. And
and you, of course, were close to Daub, very close to Daub during this time.
Well, we only, yes, I was only close to him for 2 years before he moved, because he moved in 55 to Oxford.
So was he just down the passage?
Oh, yes.
Yes.
And I used to go and discuss my dissertation with him at his home. Because there was a problem, should I get a Scottish legal qualification? I thought there was no reason why I couldn't be a solicitor in England and an advocate in Scotland,
yeah.
But I discovered that there was some agreement that you couldn't do that. So I thought, well, people said you must have some sort of Scottish legal qualification. So I did a PhD at Aberdeen, and a little bit in Scots law.
Did he supervise you, Daub?
Yes. Yes, he suggested the topic, which was culpa in contrahendo, which is, that was the title, in effect, of my dissertation, which was Fault in the Formation of Contract.
Fascinating. And so presumably you he was a very, I would think, super supportive supervisor.
Oh, yes. No, he was an excellent teacher. And I suppose he's influenced me more than any other.
Any recollections of him during this period?
Well, I remember, sitting in his study in Osborne Place, Aberdeen, across the fire. Oh,
sounds lovely.
But
Professor Lipstein told me that when he first came here in 1934, he was doing Roman law, but he quickly decided to give it a miss because Dauber was here as well.
Yes.
And he was, by Professor Lipstein's, in his own words, he was much better at it.
Well.
So Professor Lipstein concentrated on private international law.
Yes.
Yes. So was he a very a kind man, Dauber?
Oh, yes.
As well as being very brilliant, he was very
kind.
Oh,
he was a very generous man, generous with his time and affection.
Yes. So so it was must have been
so
quite a loss when he moved, when he went to...
Yes, I was very upset at the time, but I liked Aberdeen very much, and I think I might have stayed there, but the main problem was that you never had any graduate students there, because once they graduated with honours, they went away. Well, it was partly the policy to send them either to Oxford or Cambridge or to an American university to get further experience. And
I noticed in your article in Juris Uprooted that you said that Roman law really wasn't a London, Cambridge, Oxford subject.
Yes. Well, you see, although every university then had to have some sort of elementary course in Roman law because you needed it for the bar, but the only ones that really had sort of chairs in Roman law were Oxford, Cambridge and London, and the Scottish universities, because Roman law was much more influential in Scotland than in England.
So you were very young when you became the professor in jurisprudence. You were only 30.
Yes.
That must have been one of the youngest
very lucky
appointments.
Well, yes, Aberdeen did sometimes appoint people young. Two of the professors, when I became professor there, had been younger than I was when they started, the professor of Greek and one of the divinity professors. I was very lucky.
You became Dean of the Law Faculty at Aberdeen in 1961.
Really?
Yes, and this was lasted until 68. Do you have any recollections of your time in this office?
Well, there were only three professors. The Professor of Scots Law, the Professor of Jurisprudence and the Professor of Conveyancing, who was part-time. And they took it in turns to be dean, which just meant you chaired faculty meetings.
So, yes. Do you have any other reminiscences of your time in Aberdeen, of the faculty, perhaps the King's College site?
The law had been located in Old Aberdeen on the King's College site before I came there, and it was in a converted church, because the Scots are always rearranging their ecclesiastical arrangements. And, you know, the Free Church and the United Free and all that. But I felt we were lucky with the library. They enabled me, De Zulueta, been at Oxford, sold his own library, a private library of Roman law books, to Aberdeen. Before he died, and so I had this nucleus of Roman law in the library there, and they very kindly agreed to maintain it. They bought more or less anything that I asked for.
So you must have developed the library's collections,
yes,
considerably.
At Aberdeen, yes.
Yes.
I did.
And the subject itself, because it's still very strong, isn't it?
Well, it's... Fortunately, the present principal, who's a historian, but he did Roman law with me while he was an undergraduate in arts. He could do it in arts or in law. And he's very keen to maintain Roman law.
Who is he, Professor?
Duncan Rice.
Right.
R-I-C-E.
Did you find the differences between English and Scottish, the Scottish legal and educational systems quite...
Oh, well, yes, you have to keep separate in your mind. But I never did get a Scottish professional qualification. I had the Aberdeen PhD. But otherwise I stayed as an English solicitor. Well, I sweated blood to become an English solicitor. I didn't really want to
give it up. No. Yeah. Meeting up with David Daub again introduced you to people like Kane, who had an influence on your research. You mentioned...
Yeah, well, Darby used to be a great one for inviting people to come to Aberdeen. And I met Kane quite early and talked to him about his plans. And I was one of the first people on the scientific council of his Max Planck Institute for Legal History. And I kept in touch with what he was doing, because I always felt that it was a little bit artificial to stop studying Roman law with Justinian, that one should really go on and discuss this and study what had happened in the Middle Ages, the Jus Commune and all that.
Yes.
But so going was in the forefront of that, but also there were other important figures for Roman law, like Casa.
So did you meet him in this time?
Yes.
Also through David Dalber.
Yes, but by the time I became professor myself, I used to go to conferences,
of course,
and meet people there.
Yes.
So that was...
Any recollections of going or cars?
Well... I suppose... I see you've got down my colleagues.
Yes.
Yeah, I suppose the dominant personality in Aberdeen was T.B. Smith, who later became Sir Thomas Smith when he moved to Edinburgh.
Right.
But he dominated Aberdeen. He revived law, which had previously been a sort of part-time study, and
so I mean, if you think of in comparison with other disciplines, the formalizing of legal studies was a relatively late development, which only
well, it had always sort of hung on by its fingertips, but because the chair of law, which was Scots law, became who had been there from the beginning. But whereas jurisprudence was a new foundation, and there was a principal of the university who was a lawyer, who had previously been professor of Scots law, Sir Thomas Taylor, and he was very influential.
Well, that takes us up to the end of your time at Aberdeen, and...
Yes, I'm afraid I can't remember very clearly. I left Aberdeen in...
68,
yes. That was when Professor Duff retired. Yeah.
And you...
And I was appointed
to his chair.
To succeed.
Yes.
Yes. I was never elected. You're always... Because the Regis chairs, you were appointed.
Yeah. It's one of the most prestigious chairs.
I'm a Harold Wilson appointment. Because the letter I got from Downing Street says, Mr. Wilson would like to give your name to Her Majesty. So I said, yes, please.
So you must have left Aberdeen with mixed feelings. I mean,
oh, yes.
You liked it there very much.
I did. And it was with mixed feelings, but I felt, well, a bit more wider opportunities in Cambridge. And, of course, I knew Cambridge, although I'd been away in effect, nearly 20 years.
Yes, that's right. I mean, you weren't...
I came down
yes.
In 49. And it was 68.
But you'd already mapped out your career by the time you came back to Cambridge. You'd already established yourself as a world...
No,
...authority.
I knew I could hang on to that chair. And that was, I mean, in a way that was my ambition, to get one of the Regis chairs. And... I knew Duff, and I think Duff and Dalber probably recommended me to the patronage secretary of the Prime Minister, who's the person who actually made the appointment in those days.
Interesting. Well, perhaps... Next time we can talk about your time at Cambridge and your colleagues at Cambridge, and I might just be able to ask you about the background to some of your books. I notice, do you actually have a bibliography, Professor Stein, which I might look at?
Probably somewhere.
What I've compiled so far, it strikes me that you wrote a good many books, long works.
Well, I mean, that's...
Your last one.
Yes, which is translated. The only one I made any money out of. That's translated into a number of languages.
I was looking at it myself, and it seems to me to be quite an accessible text, which is why I'm going to buy it, because I would like to read it as well. And I don't like reading these library books because what people do to them.
Oh dear.
I find that very annoying.
I know it is.
And, it looks like a book which somebody...
Yes, it was originally published in German.
Ah.
Because it was commissioned
right.
by Fisher Verlag for a series of pocket books, Taschenbuch.
Oh.
And...
Interesting. Yeah. Well...
But I made a condition that I wrote it in English and they translated it, or they we arranged a friend of mine, a German professor, he volunteered to translate it into German. So that, and the great attraction from my point of view was that there were pictures you could have, so I could choose about a dozen pictures.